Hello, hello. I'm Winter Mitchell, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. Guy is on assignment, so with me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
I'm bringing the winter.
academic and DJ Oliver Wang.
Hello, Winter.
Would you say winter, spring?
No, I was going about to say Davis.
Oh,
thanks. You're killing it.
Thank you, brother.
I can't see it, but geez, winter's looking good.
We'll take a photo.
Jumpsuit.
For the group. And a very special guest. Very special. The VP of original content for Comic-Con HQ and technology reporter and my very good friend and mentor, Sarah Lane.
Thanks for calling me your mentor. It's good to be here.
I love you.
Don't pay much attention to what I do.
Oh, I won't. I never usually do. I just like your company.
No, it's great. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, dude. Coming up in this week's show, Working Women in Pop Culture. Plus, we'll be each sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Oliver, what is this?
What do you mean, what is this? Like, what did I put down or like just what's going on in general?
What did you put down?
All right. So Hong Kong film director Wong Kar-wai, who did Chungking Express, In the Mood for Love, Happy Together, he has a new memoir out called WKW that he co-authored with John Powers. And the Academy hosted a conversation between himself and his superfan Mad Men's creator Matthew Weiner last week at the Samuel Goldwyn Theater. And it was fantastic, I have to say. I mean, I think like a lot of people who kind of came of age in the 1990s, especially if you're Asian, you really love Wong Kar-wai stuff because him, along with cinematographer Christopher Doyle, really captured this incredibly, you know, not even really nostalgic, but romantic, nostalgia-infused, longing-infused aesthetic that ran through all of his many different kinds of films. So it doesn't matter if he was making sort of more of a drama, more of, you know, he did kung fu films, you know, in the 90s. He did gangster films, but they all had the same kind of feel and texture to them. And I think it's a big reason why Wong Kar-wai has such a cult following. And so I've always loved his films, but never having seen him speak in person before, he was great. He was funny. He was insightful. It makes me really want to read the memoir to kind of get a sense of his creative process, and just thoroughly enjoyed just being able to hear him talk about, you know, his craft and his creative process.
What is something that I would know him from? Because I may have missed the beginning.
I think In the Mood for Love is probably his best known film, and
yes,
with Tony Leung and Maggie Cheung wearing incredible Cheung Sums, basically.
Yeah. Is that Shanghai in the 40s or something like that?
It is. It's Hong Kong in the 60s.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So it is a period film. The outfits and fashion in it are incredible. A lot of people smoking.
A lot of smoking and a lot of like touching, but nothing else.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. A lot of repression.
Unrequited love.
Yes. A lot of repression right there.
That sounds fantastic. What would he do now? What do you think his touch would be if he were – is he still making movies? Or
he is, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So but he doesn't really have anything that's sort of U.S. – more Western.
You know, like a lot of filmmakers who hit it big in Asia, he was given sort of the one American film that
which
he got to
do. Which one was that?
I think it was called My Blueberry Hill or My Blueberry Pie.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Which was not well received. And he had no experience working with basic unions. And so he was telling us just – the first 2 weeks was a crash course in learning the regulations that govern, like Hollywood extras, for example. Like, you're not supposed to talk to them because then they become day workers, and that's a whole other complication. So he was just basically saying that he had to learn, like, from scratch how to properly work within Hollywood regulations because they don't have any of
that. You're not supposed to talk to extras?
Apparently, if the director gives an extra a direction, they're no longer extras, and now they become day laborers, and they qualify for a SAG card. I'm probably getting all of this wrong, but
no, you're pretty much right.
Okay, so there you go.
I would totally do. I would totally find a way to work myself into a daily.
Union rules in the entertainment industry are the most ruthless of them all.
And all I know is a scale plus 10.
Yeah, and much respected unions. I mean, nothing. Yeah, he wasn't being anti-union about it. He was just saying, I had no idea this is how things worked over here. And so that was the one sort of U.S. production that he's worked on. But everything else has either been Hong Kong or mainland China.
Bummer. Well, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
Margaret. I'm the worst. Margaret.
Real quick before I get into what I'm all about, I want to say that there was a winner at last of the Pop Rocket Summer Book Club.
Woo-woo!
So get your book. It's Sleeping Giants by Sylvain Neuvel. And I highly encourage all of you to get it from an independent bookstore or to get it from a library. If you have to get it from Amazon, I understand. That's where I get all my vitamins and stuff. But at any rate, we're going to start reading this. Official start date for reading is June 1st. And we're going to talk about it in the last week of June. So get ready for that.
All right.
That was the one I wanted anyway, so great.
Cool. Yeah, it seemed like, I mean, narrowly beat out the Turner House, which I'm going to end up reading anyway.
Fine.
but then my other all about is The Night Manager, which is based on a John le Carre novel. And it's, I'm actually behind in it. I've only seen 2 out of the 6 episodes that have aired on AMC, but I'm really hooked so far. And I didn't really expect to be hooked because it felt like a little bit of a paint-by-numbers British spy thriller type of thing. But it is really pretty perfectly done. For one thing, the locations are killer. Like, amazing shots of Switzerland, amazing shots of Cairo. It has Tom Hiddleston as Pine, who, when you first meet Pine, he's a hotel manager. He's a night manager at this posh Cairo hotel. And he gets involved with this woman who is the girlfriend of a very seedy, mafia-like boss in Cairo. And the kind of white whale of the whole show is Hugh Laurie, who plays Richard Roper, who's this international arms dealer, but who poses as this do-gooder. And so basically Pine is chasing after Roper, and it's just, it's sexy, it's slick, it's really well done. It's like what Bond should be. And of course, as we all know, Tom Hiddleston is being considered for Bond, along with Idris Elba and some other people. Gillian Anderson now, apparently, in her dreams. But at any rate, I hope he gets it.
I think he's a little too puny to play Bond. I don't know.
I disagree. When you have to see this, because he can bring it.
Like, I'm holding out for Idris.
You are? I'm holding out for Idris, too.
I mean, could anyone say they don't want him to be James Bond?
I just don't see
Gillian
any other
Anderson,
way around it.
I can
I would
that.
Love yeah. him to be Bond, but for I feel like they've already said, oh, he's not
white enough,
basically.
I disagree.
Is there a scene featuring Mr. Roper and the Regal Beagle someplace? Sorry, couldn't help it.
Wait, what about you, Sarah? You were saying that Idris, you know.
I mean, he's a very authoritative, handsome. He would be the perfect
slick and dashing
Bond.
And debonair.
And also, come on, man. Aren't we ready for James Bond not to be too white? I mean, who?
I wasn't
absolutely.
Impressed by Daniel Craig as James Bond. And given his...
Always thought he was overrated.
Overrated. His eyes are serial killer to me. I just...
He has a funny face.
He has a funny... Supine? Is that the word?
Supine.
Like laying down?
Supine. No.
Lupine?
With the face, when your face looks almost like a cat, not feline.
Feral?
I think feline is what you were going
yes.
for,
was it?
Actually.
I would be terrible at Scrabble. Or Jeopardy or Wheel of Fortune. I want to watch that, Margaret, The Night Manager. I don't like Hugh Laurie either.
You know, I am warming
I need
up to
like
him.
3 or 4 people in a show before. You know what I mean? And,
I hear you.
We're 2 for 2 here.
I'm warming up to him, Hugh Laurie. He's not my favorite either, but so far he is killing it in this role. I mean, both him and Tom Hiddleston are like, okay, I'm going to take you guys seriously.
All right.
You're more than British fops.
All right. All right.
Is that a word?
Yeah, sure. Fop. Foppy? Isn't that what they referred to? What's his face? Grant, Hugh Grant. They were always calling him foppish.
Yes.
Yes.
And then he hooked up with a stripper, and then he was just smug. Because that was their true. Polite way of saying you're a hoe.
Yeah.
Sarah.
Yes.
You want to talk about this show that I don't watch.
Oh. I have not seen this latest episode.
I feel like you have to leave the room.
I might have to.
Because it's
Margaret,
a really
you gotta
big
get
episode.
Out, Wobbler.
Okay, I'm going to get out for a second.
My God.
Get out.
Wow. This is like, the first life spoiler alert we've ever done. On Pop Rocket.
I'm like, I'm not kidding. You got to get out of here.
I don't care, and neither does Oliver, so go for it.
Yeah,
oh, good. Okay, so I don't know how often anyone talks about Game of Thrones on the show. If
well, she watches it. So,
two of you don't watch it regularly.
We just did an entire episode.
Great. And you've never seen the show?
No, I don't have any interest.
Well, you know, you're not the first person.
Tweet your own.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm not even a huge fantasy person, really.
Okay.
But Game of Thrones is my life.
Okay.
And I'm not. even saying that lightly. It's truly my life. Sunday night revolves around it. But anyway, this Sunday was a very important episode for the furthering of the story. And you guys don't care if I say what I need to say because it doesn't matter to you.
I've been on Twitter since Sunday, so I already know what you're probably
going
to say.
Yeah. Well, anyway, one of the main characters, very beloved character, dies. And we find out why he was the way that he was, which in many cases you could say would be the equivalent of, you know, some sort of a, you know, a simpleton or, you know, somebody who doesn't have, you know, a super advanced mind, right?
Okay.
And he can only say his own name, which is Hodor, over and over. That's the only word he says throughout the whole series. And we're on season six. And so it's like, yeah, I wonder what ever happened to him, but nobody ever says. So there's this whole thing that's sort of built around, and it's very,
like an origin episode?
It's sort of an origin episode. Nothing in Game of Thrones is ever, it's like it weaves through many years, and then you're like, oh, who is that guy?
Oh, God,
he was the uncle of the dead king.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. It's an exercise in insanity. But anyway, this was a very big episode, and every season on Game of Thrones, there's one of these. I mean, you don't watch the show, but you've probably heard of the Red Wedding.
Oh, yes. The party that everybody got killed.
That's one of those episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So this was, it was just, you kind of didn't see it coming, mm-hmm. and it was kind of scary, and there was sort of the zombie element of Game of Thrones that was a big part of it, and I'm watching alone, covers over my head, kind of thing. So, and then I had to watch it again last night, and
I saw
something
hold the door.
That I hadn't seen.
Hold the door. What did the hold the door mean?
Hold the door was what he was doing when he was saving people that he loves. But then you do like this whole flashback scene to when he was a kid, when he could still talk.
Oh.
And hold the door becomes Hodor, which is his name.
Oh.
And it's just like, what the F?
That was sad.
How did they do that? It's really sad. It's really sad. But it's also really clever writing.
Here's the thing that I do appreciate the show for. This is having never seen an episode. I appreciate the fandom. I appreciate the fandom more than Star Wars. Star Wars, to me at this point, especially with Chewbacca Lady, I love her. God bless Candace Payne. She brought so much sunshine into my life. But it just goes to show you sort of like the groupthink mindfuckery that is Star Wars. But Game of Thrones seems incredibly, like, people really find the intelligentsia. I feel like the intelligentsia, like, they really are drawn to it, and it piques something in people that's a little bit more substantial than just a traditional, I love Star Wars, I'm a Trekkie, I'm a furry.
Well, the one thing about Game of Thrones that's the huge distinction is it's an adult show.
Yeah.
There's nudity, there's swearing, there's, like,
baby
gratuitous
raping.
Acts of violence. I mean, really disgusting sometimes.
Baby raping.
This is...
Baby raping.
I don't think that ever happened, but some really bad things happen to babies.
Well, just bad things happen to babies that don't.
Bad things happen to everyone.
Dog abuse.
Oh, Whopper wants to come back in.
Come back in now.
I think. Yeah, we're now just talking about.
She just holds the door.
We're now just
ran around the block, got a pizza,
yeah,
ran some errands,
doing your thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about what happened, Wobbler, but I'm after this week's episode, because I felt like it was an emotional response that was unlike anything else. The Red Wedding seemed like very, you know, out to shock.
You haven't even seen the show.
I don't even know what's happening. Who's coming on next week? Is it Oliver, Cousin Oliver?
What, on Game of Thrones? They probably should. I'm trying to how to ask this without spoiling anything. What happened? Is that unique to the show, or is this also reflected in the books, or supposed to be? Because we're past the book.
That's correct.
Right, so we have no idea.
None of this is a spoiler anymore. If you're a fan of the show, you know that the show has now jumped in front of the books.
Okay.
And so they're writing their own story.
So in theory, what could happen could not exist within Martin's telling of the same
he's
story.
A consultant. Who knows how much he is?
Right,
but,
right.
You know, one would think that he's feeding them the actual story.
That'd be
in
awesome
some
if it was completely different, just to fuck with people and just be like, fuck your canon. I mean,
no, that's what the show does. It just fucks with everyone and makes us cry.
I kind of like George R. R. Martin for that.
I know.
Yeah, he's
seriously.
He's mean.
He's mean, old
he's mean,
bastard.
He's mean to his best characters.
And he grunts when he eats. I know for facts.
Well, he's a, you know, he's hungry.
So winter,
next
what are,
to him once.
What are you all about?
Oh, the lobster. Oh, gosh. Speaking of food, I went this weekend and I saw The Lobster, which is the new Colin Farrell, Rachel Weisz movie set in a dystopian version of Earth. it is a one big mind fuck. It's 2 hours, which is my limit, especially when my head's being screwed about. It's about a man who is recently separated from his partner, his wife. We never see her. And he is visited upon by a group of officials who let him know that he has 45 days to find a new mate or he'll be turned into an animal. So they go to a hotel, which is literally like the hotel in The Shining, the Overlook. And they are in a hotel that's sort of like a really fucked up, like Cabo all-inclusive resort. And the rules are he can't masturbate. They all have to wear the same clothing. They have group activities where they have – it's a little bit of sharing and it's a little bit of mingling and dancing. It's very – it reminds me of Her, Drained of Color and Technology. Once he gets to the hotel, the process is just – it's so interesting because everybody in the movie is desperate for something and they can't obtain anything without getting this partner. So you don't really learn about their dreams or their hopes or their passions. Their one singular goal is mating and not being turned into a dog or any animal they choose. The funny thing about it is that they're resigned to it, so they have to make a choice at the beginning when they check in. Which animal would you like to become? He chooses the lobster because it lives for a long time and it gets to swim and he's a great swimmer. His brother, this is a spoiler, I don't care. His brother is a dog, so he brings his brother with him. His brother had already been changed over. It was... Rachel Weisz is amazing in it. She's amazing in everything.
She's amazing.
Don't like Daniel Craig, but I love your wife.
What about Colin Farrell? Because I used to dislike him, but he's grown on me over the years.
I've liked him in this more than I've liked him in anything. He's so good. He's got like this Joaquin Phoenix thing going for me. Like I like Dad Bod.
Is this a dark comedy or is this not comedic at all?
Okay, this is the part that's weird. My girlfriends and I were laughing the entire time.
I bet you were the only ones, though.
Yes, dude. We were the only ones. And I wasn't – look, I think I'm a cultured person, so I wasn't laughing at parts where it should – it was funny to me. And I think because we're in the midst of – we feel that pressure. So it really was an examination on the pressure of dating and feeling like – I'm running out of time. I'm running out of hot years. So what am I going to do? Am I going to turn into like a freaking like
warthog?
Warthog.
that would be your animal.
That
I
would
think
be
you
my...
should choose again.
Warthogs
honey.
Crush. They take over entire islands.
Oh, well,
you know that's
okay,
true.
Okay.
It was just sort of like I got the subtle intonations into it. Everybody else, there's a lot of couples there, so maybe they didn't think it was that funny. And I read an article that said this is not a date movie, and it's not. It's just not.
I appreciate, though, that they added some kind of surreal concept to the romantic comedy.
Yes.
Because that's been – nobody does that. Right. Everyone just does the same story basically over and over and over again, and nobody ever adds like an absurdist or surreal touch.
But was it a comedy?
It was – there was –
because it sounds pretty dark.
I mean, it's romantic, right?
It's romantic dramedy.
Okay. You could say that Her had some comedic moments, but right. I wouldn't have called that a comedy.
No, but there was like some parts of it that – some parts of Her that I think were played for comedy. I think this movie in particular was much more played for – they want to have a comment on what is actually existing in society.
It's like,
but then
a heartstrings thing that's like a souped up version of reality.
Right. And, yeah. And you know, there's one sequence where he actually meets someone and she has no heart. And that's, they call her heartless. And she is just completely drained and void of emotion. And he starts being drained and void of emotion because he's approaching like 4 or 5 days left if he doesn't mate with someone. And Just showing the desperation you will go into just for acceptance. There's so many layers, and I was all in for it. And if this movie had come out 4 or 5 months later on in the year, I would say for sure him and Colin and Rachel would be nominated for either a Globe or an Oscar.
It feels like a Globe. Yeah,
it's a Globe. Yeah, it feels like a Globe. Right. It feels like a Globe
it's quirky,
scenario.
It's quirky.
Yeah. And then they can dazzle people at their little fancy private dinners. Oscars, maybe not so much, but I loved it.
Well,
great.
The Globes also have movies that win for comedies, and you're like, was that a comedy?
Was that a comedy?
that is their specialty.
That is their you're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk working women in pop culture after this.
I'm Biz.
And I'm Teresa.
And we host the podcast One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting.
Parenthood. It turns out it is very difficult, but we all get up every day and do it again.
It's like the sign says, if you're going through hell, keep going.
So join us each week as we strive for less judging and more laughing.
Find us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts when your children aren't around.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Winter Mitchell, filling in for Guy Branum. And with me in the studio are...
Sarah Lane.
Margaret Wappler.
And Oliver Wang.
Woot! We're going to talk about your favorite representation of women working in film and television, women doing what we have to fucking do to overcome the patriarchal bullshit that we exist in society.
Sing it.
I mean, I'm just saying. This is a topic near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, why'd you pick
this? And of course, Oliver wants to say something.
Why did you pick this?
I picked this because having been a working woman for 20 years, since I was 16, I've experienced pretty much every single possible example of BS that one can deal with in the workplace, but I've also been party to it. So I've learned a lot about myself in working environments. I've learned a lot about other people in working environments. But I've also, how I feel about work now is a completely different space than I would have even said a year ago. I'm completely motivated to do what my passion is now more than ever. But I'm still inspired and fascinated by women who have made a place for themselves that brings them much pleasure and happiness. Sarah would be one. Wappler is another. Somebody who just finds passion in their art, in their artistry, and then moving forward and doing that. And I'm kind of in that space right now where I'm kind of owning it. But I like talking about working women in film and television.
Well, one of your favorite movies is Working Girl,
oh,
right?
Oh, yes.
I finally watched that for the first time a few months ago. I almost, like, texted you because I was like, oh, my God, I'm watching the Winter Bible here.
What did you think about it?
I loved it. I also loved the fact that it was so, like, her teased out 80s hair.
Yes.
And their whole look of being, what was it, like, the secretaries with the big shoulder pads and the Reeboks, like,
yeah,
walking to the train. I once was that exact kind of secretary character for Halloween.
Real? Oh, so was I.
Really?
Yes.
I thought you were going to say, you know, when I was younger.
Yeah.
You were like, for Halloween,
for
I did that.
For Halloween, I did that.
Right, because we're, like, we're post-Reeboks to the train generation.
You know.
Oh, man, in New York City, you still see a lot of that.
It's still?
Oh, yeah. Gotta have comfort.
Well, I just feel like in the 80s, it was a dawning of a new era. And I think a lot of that has to do with sort of my mom and dad's generation. There were two parent households. So my mom, you know, I always still think to this day, like, how she balanced all that stuff. Because you see these women in the movies in the 80s, there was one or the other. There wasn't like both. It was, you're going to be a stay-at-home mom or you're going to be working out in the world. And when you work out in the world, you're too busy to do anything else. You can't date. You can't do anything but have dinner with, like, jerks. Like, so I, like, that's why I wanted to talk about that. I think my first question, Margaret knows mine. What's your favorite representation of working women in film and television, Sarah?
Well, I mean, before we started the show, somebody had written down Alien, and it's almost, I mean, I don't even know if you... Yes, you would definitely call that working.
I was working real hard.
Working
actually.
Real hard in a world.
In a space capacity, right. Running a ship and fighting aliens. But I mean, if
having
you're talking...
one rip out of your body, potentially.
All of those things. I mean, how brave, right? but honestly, I mean, I think that that's probably the of the spectrum of badassery. That's way at the top.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think you get more badass than that. And I'm talking about the whole franchise, not just the movie.
You didn't like she sacrificed herself in a hell of fire.
All of it.
All of it. What about you, Oliver?
So in thinking about this question, I couldn't necessarily come up with one person, but it did make me think through everything that I watched on television, especially in the 70s and 80s growing up, in addition to having a mom who worked. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, everyone from, you know, even something as simple as the women in Laverne and Shirley, like they were blue-collar workers going to the brewery. But that was sort of front and center. You think about the waitresses on Alice. You know, you think about moving into the 80s.
Kiss my grits!
Exactly. You think about, for me, Claire Huxtable comes to mind off of The Cosby Show. All of the women on L.A. Law. Obviously, by the time you get to the mid-late 80s, you have Murphy Brown.
Yep.
And even the only example I was trying to think of. So what housewives did I grow up watching? And the only one that really came to mind were reruns of Bewitched. But, of course, Samantha was supposed to be this very subversive twist on the kind of Beverly Cleaver trope, because she might have been a housewife, but she also has crazy magical June Cleaver. Sorry, she has crazy magical powers. So you know, there was no sort of standard.
But she was working because she was hustling and always trying to fix people's shit.
Exactly. So I think I basically grew up
like a prototype for a therapist.
Yeah,
that too. So I grew up in a generation where the women that I saw in television and films were all women who were working, and there was no sort of alternative to that, really. Which is why, and this kind of goes back to when we were talking about Ali Wong's Baby Cobra special.
Yes.
I think part of why I didn't really find her whole thing about I just want to be at home and taken care of, I didn't find it really funny, only because I couldn't identify with it at all, just because that was no secret desire that I knew from anyone represented to me or in my personal life in terms of either my mom. Because when my mom couldn't work anymore because of my dad's job and where they had to move to, I think she fell into a very deep depression around it. And so,
do you think that was very anti-Tiger Mom? Because that surprised me too. That was the only thing that shocked me, because she seems like such a go-getter. I'm going to do all of this. I'm going to, you know, take everybody's balls and eat them and throw them away. And then she's like, but I want to sit at home.
Yeah, I don't know. There's something
that felt weird.
There's something
disjointed
about that I found incongruous.
Yes.
But it also might be that
Asian woman to say that, I was shocked. Absolutely appalled.
I mean, I think these days, again, being a housewife is subversive, which is why Real Housewives, you know, of fill in the blank city, that's the one depiction of housewives that you get to see. But it's sort of taken at this crazy extreme.
Sure. Well, I was reading about the study that Gina Davis's Institute did about women and jobs on TV.
Oh, I read it too.
Yeah. And they were talking about how the bastion of jobs for women is through reality TV. When you watch a reality TV show, those are real people, so they do have real jobs. Whereas, like, actual scripted dramas and comedies, only something like 42% of the women have jobs in those. That to me is interesting, because I remember watching, like, Bachelor and seeing, you know, when they first introduced the women, like, what jobs they have. And you hear everything. You know, you hear nurse and teacher and CEO and whatever.
Dental assistant.
A lot of dental assistants.
Then you have a series like Mad Men, which is literally, I mean, it's sort of about, it's about him, but it's actually about women in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the whole show starts on one end of the spectrum, again, that spectrum. And then by the end of the show, you're like, oh, look, Peggy's going to run everything. You know, it's like, and that's something that we as people of the, you know, next millennium are like, oh, yeah, things were different.
It's almost
things
like
were really different over, you know, a period of 20 years. Things changed a lot.
It's almost like it's not even a real time. And I know, Margaret, like you mentioned Mad Men in yours. It's still to this. I know it exists. I know it happened. I know it's still happening. But it almost seems like it's not real. It seems completely unreal to me. That's why when things like that happen today in the workplace, I'm like, are you fucking kidding me?
You know, it's funny because when I watch Peggy and Joan struggle on Mad Men, I still feel some relationship to that. Like, of course, what I have struggled through as a working woman is not comparable to what they've struggled through. Mm-hmm. It's not nearly as bad, but right. I've had tastes of that for sure.
Sure.
I mean, I remember when I was a teenager working as a cashier at this Italian restaurant, and I found out that I worked there for a long time. This guy that worked there with me, who did the exact same job and we were the exact same age, mm-hmm. was paid a dollar more, mm-hmm. I found out. And I asked the owners, I said, why is John paid a dollar more than me? And they were like, because he's a guy. I mean, they just said that to me straight up. And I'm a 16, 17-year-old girl, and there was no apologies for it. And when I asked for more, they were just like, no, sorry. So, I mean, that's just like a taste of my life, and that still happens all the time, of course. I mean, we know what the statistics are about, you know, women being paid 75 cents to the dollar and even less if you're a non-white woman. So, I mean, I think it's 100% real. It may not happen in the same way as it did on Mad Men, and you may not have somebody like Joan making the choice to sleep with a client to get ahead.
Sure.
But I'm sure that happens too.
It's interesting because men in the workplace want their women the way they want their women. And I've always found that I'm, you know, I'm obnoxious, I'm sarcastic, but I got a heart of gold. Like, I care. I'm pretty loyal to whomever I'm working for at that time. And what I found is that men generally want their women to be incredibly feminine to a point. So don't cry. You know, be sexy, but don't turn me on. Be smart and intelligent. Don't make mistakes. But if you do make a mistake, I'm going to, you know, like, I can throw you under the bus if I decide how I feel on that day. Men just sort of, I found, you know, like with Murphy Brown, for instance. Murphy Brown was a sexual woman. You know, mm-hmm. she also was so too busy to notice if she had a new secretary every episode because she had real shit going on. And it was, and I always found that funny. But she was always felt like the kind of woman I really related to growing up.
Well, it's interesting about her character.
Weirdly.
Because when she became politically dangerous is when she has a child on the show.
Sure.
And that's when Dan Quayle, you know, made his famous statement about like Murphy Brown should be married or whatever it was.
Which is crazy to hear. That was in the 80s when we should have already been past the
line. I'm sure Ted Cruz would say the same thing today.
Yep.
Ted Cruz with his fucking throat.
I mean,
crumbs spitting up on his lip. I don't want to think about it.
There are a lot of people, pardon me, who still think that, you know.
Yeah.
That's not cool.
Well, they just wanted
her. Not a good role model.
But they wanted her in a certain way. They wanted her. She was supposed to be a news anchor, an anchor woman. And they just want, you know, he felt like in order to insert myself into this converse, this national conversation, I'm going to choose her of all people. She was one of the best representations of women on television in the 1980s.
You know, Winter, it's funny that you mentioned bosses, male bosses, not wanting to see women cry.
Yeah, they hate it.
You know, crying is one of those things that, I mean, I'm not much of a crier, but if
no,
I get angry enough, there's like a crying thing that sometimes happens because you're just like, and you cannot do that at work.
You can't.
And I know it. But it's like sometimes it's a thing you have to like hold back because that's a sometimes women just go down that road and then they're.
I give a warning.
They're.
I'm going to cry.
Well, sometimes you just. Sometimes you don't know. It's like throwing
can't
up.
Do it. I've
cried at every job because I am a crier. And
yeah.
It's like, this is just who I am, people. Sorry.
You either want me to cry.
I'll probably cry later in this podcast.
But
I'm
that's the thing
cry
that I
cry in my car later.
We're all going to cry in our
We're
cars
all gonna
later.
We're going to cry.
But that's, you know, again, that's a thing. Like, why is that not okay if it's something that happens to so many people and it's a natural part of being emotional?
Yeah, but men can make stupid fucking comments and sexually harass everybody. But God forbid I shed a tear and have an emotion.
But, you know, going back to the whole single mom thing with Murphy Brown being dangerous in that way is that that is something else that Gina Davis' study pointed out is that the working women that you see on TV don't have kids most of the time.
Most of the time.
And I do think that is a real gap in the representation because that would be I mean, I just don't feel like single moms are seen enough on TV. We don't know what that hustle is. I thought Marcia Clark, her character in OJ.
Was one of the first.
Well, at first in like a obviously a real trial. I mean, the show that we all loved that came on earlier this year, I think that was the first time that I saw a character in a while who was a single mom, working single mom, who was really struggling with it.
Right. Go ahead, Oliver.
Well, I was going to say, I guess One Day at a Time was with Valerie Bertinelli and God, who played the mom in that. But that was a single mom show. And I think that was probably one of the, you know, it kind of came out of the 70s and 80s wave of looking at kind of alternative American families.
Sure.
And like the first divorce wave, the first like divorce spike.
And then also, I mean, if you think about Silver Spoon, I mean, it's not about single moms, but about single dad. You had Silver Spoon. Different strokes? I mean, was there a mother? There was no mother.
Well, there was always a mother figure.
Okay,
they always had
like
the housekeeper or somebody.
What about
around?
My two dads?
Oh, my two
dads. No mom at all.
My two dads. You know, this sort of this part of the conversation sort of goes into what I wanted to. I also wanted to touch on Sheryl Sandberg because you know, working women in television cinema. I would consider her a part of this conversation because she works for what is ostensibly at this point a large news organization as well as being a media platform and social network. But, you know, she pushed out her messaging about Lean In pretty hard and had a lot of accolades and got a lot of people invested in that movement. And then she unfortunately and sadly lost her partner. And now she's sort of backtracking on the notion that everybody must just you know, you need a partner if you're going to get this done. Mm-hmm. And I never thought of her comments as being as archaic because I felt like she's a billionaire, he's a multimillionaire, they'll be fine. But then something catastrophic and outrageous happens. And I always think of in any movie when the woman loses her husband, there's always this push in the movie to mate her off or get her laid or, you know, let her get upset and sad, but not too upset and sad. So I just thought maybe we can talk a little bit about sort of what how it feels to for somebody so public, somebody so important and magnanimous to have to sort of back up off of a statement that she was earned a lot off of, you know?
I admire her for correcting her statement. Yeah. I mean, I read the Facebook post that she made earlier today that she made around Mother's Day saying that it had been about a year or so since her husband had died. And since then, she's really learned what it means to be a single mom and to struggle through that. And she notes that she has real financial privilege, of course, but that she still is struggling because suddenly to do it all by yourself is a lot. And I think it was good for her to, I wouldn't say she's completely retracted the lean in message, but I think she's built in more nuance to it, saying that basically when you're a woman on your own working and you have a family, that it's really tough. And that the, and that she also very smartly talks about how it's not just about you having to lean in. It's about the system making it easier for you to do your job.
Right.
And the system right now sucks. I mean, we're the only developed country that really does not have a proper maternal leave policy. And so she gets into all of that. And I think it's great. I mean, that's what I was waiting for her. And I think that was a lot of the critique that came at her after that book. Everyone was saying, but wait a minute, you're a billionaire. You have all these advantages. Of course you can lean in. Mm-hmm. What about the rest of us? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's good that she's finally adding some real texture to that message.
And yeah. I think anybody can, you know, there's only so much authority you can speak on. Sheryl Sandberg could not speak for widowed women raising a child and sure. working full time. I mean, she's the COO of Facebook. She works a lot.
Yeah.
That's what she's known for. She's extremely smart. But for her to be really, you know, to be grown up enough to say, wait a second, actually, I was speaking for a bunch of people that I shouldn't have been. And now is the only time I realize it for myself. I say good for her.
Oliver?
I'm good. I mean, I agree with y'all.
Who's responsible? Okay, well, then who's responsible? I agree. Oh, let me tail in on Sarah. I agree with that. Like, not many people will allow themselves to be called out and then correct themselves.
Yes.
Donald Trump. who's responsible for making accurate representations of women in film and television? Because I feel like, look, you get mad. We get mad if a man does it because then it's men taking jobs away from women. But then it's been so long since we've had a watershed Callie Curry moment with like a Thelma and Louise, which is in its 25th year, which is, again, I think I put that on here, one of, if not the best representations of women dealing with all the bullshit.
Yep.
And just tidying it up in
just
a bow.
Cutting bait on it
and tipping over that freaking mountain or plateau or mesa.
Spoiler winter.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. Sorry. Spoiler. At the end, they take the convertible and they go right away from them.
I don't think that's leaning in at all.
That's not leaning in. That's leaning out.
That's falling down.
And let's talk about that. Let's talk about that, though. What's leaning out? Like, when are you just like, fuck it? Because a lot of
I know a lot of people who've leaned right on out.
Again,
financial privilege usually has a lot to do with that.
And
that's a personal choice.
And it's a personal choice. I mean, we're told, I think we grew up in an era where your parents worked the same job 20, 30, 40 years. You get a pin and then you get another pin and then you might get a tie. And now, you know, I haven't seen representations of a woman completely just being like, fuck it in television because you're committed to doing something. Or else that's your livelihood. You're over. Is there anything out there that I'm missing?
Well, I just was remembering that Sex and the City episode where Miranda is trying to be partner at the law firm, and she's working, and she's putting in all those crazy hours that lawyers have to do. And you just see her by the end being like, you know what? I don't care about being a partner anymore.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't worth it to me.
Yeah.
And I think that is tapping into a mentality that is out there where, right, when our parents would work 40 years at the same corporation, they'd get the gold watch and the whatever. But those rewards aren't around anymore. I mean, people get laid off and people get, you know, just treated poorly at their jobs in a way that I don't feel like was happening back then. And at any rate, like, I feel like that is the leaning out that anyone can relate to, where it's like, what are you leaning into exactly? Somebody else's dream that you're trying to help them build?
Exactly.
Like, are you going to get something out of it? What are you going to get out of it? So I thought that was a really great episode for that reason.
What do you think, Sarah?
About women in the workplace? I'm into it. I'm doing it.
Everybody's doing it. It's a hip new thing.
I think when I hear advice, and I didn't read the book, so I don't know necessarily the message as deeply as I would if I had read the book and either agreed or disagreed with Sandberg's overall message. But when I hear something like that, like lean in, it means, you know, follow your dream, do what you're good at, try harder. That's kind of what I take away from it in a very general sense. And I think that I relate to that. I think if I don't do those things, then I suffer. I suffer financially. I suffer because I don't try hard enough. I don't feel, you know, proud of myself or pushing myself to new heights. And that's sort of a part of life. And the workplace is just one aspect of that.
Right.
But it kind of sounds like obvious advice to me. That's a simplified way to live your life. But sure, I think we can.
But leaning out is the obvious advice, or
leaning in. Mm-hmm. Leaning in, right? Because it's like you got to try, you got to strive. You're not supposed to rest on your laurels or give up. Mm-hmm. But life is pretty complicated.
Well, I think the thing that was frustrating about Sandberg's message is that she put the onus on women to really do that striving, and instead of saying, "But is the system really working for them?" That's what I think was so frustrating for a while about what she was saying, and
right.
It kind of is like a classic message in, you know, women's media and women's magazine, like, what are you doing wrong that's fucking up your life?
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like, no, that's not the case. It's actually the case that the system is really pretty badly rigged.
It's also a fact that she's a woman that makes people want to criticize her all that much more. Say, like, if President Obama wrote a book called Lean In, people would be like, well, anyone could be president. Look at him. Did well. Good work. But it's harder when you're taking that kind of message from a woman. And I'm a woman, and I know that this happens, and we all do it to some extent.
Right. I think I just to sort of close this out, I think about one of my favorite representations of women is broadcast news, Holly Hunter's character. And God, you know, I desperately wanted to, and I still think I will be, a broadcast journalist and a news producer, and I have been in the past. But one thing that I really found fascinating about her character is I've always identified with her is that she had to be emotional without anybody knowing. Mm. And when she revealed her vulnerabilities, that made people go, why are you being like this?
Yes.
And when she tried to sex up her image to get the attention of William Hurt's character, it made him think she was cute. Like, you know, not sexy, but like cute. Like, you know, she's trying. You look amazing. And she didn't know how to take that because that was really unusual for her. When she would take the phone cord out of the landline out of the phone and then cry and have her morning cry. And then to be able to criticize a man that she's sexually involved with and attracted to and be okay, upset, but okay with the fact that the relationship won't continue the way she saw it because her morals and her principles just won't be, like, you know, mussed up. I always found that so beautiful. And I watched that movie very often because not many women have the freedom to be that way. Somebody who knows himself and knows their role and their work very well, takes a level of confidence that's very hard to sort of
Well, she's real.
Now.
Yeah, she's real and she's complex. And I think sometimes there can be this depiction of the working woman where she does everything 10 times better.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And she's not allowed to have any flaws and she's not allowed to mess up because
right.
she
but
has to be
But she yelled
perfect.
In that movie and she screamed and she...
And she cried.
And she cried.
A lot.
She cursed people out. And she was okay with being alone at the very in the end.
Are we going to talk about Ghostbusters?
Yes, let's quickly talk about Ghostbusters. We have to. Sorry, Colin, you're just going to have to deal with it.
I mean, we got to.
We got to. Ghostbusters, I don't know if anybody's following all this bullshit from all these fuck boys, but basically, somebody had the grand idea of, you know, Paul Feig and Sony, or yes. Universal. Sony, they're making remaking Ghostbusters. And as one of my best friends, Jake Ginski, said, what the fuck? Does anybody just sit here and watch Ghostbusters and just, you know, like it's a wonderful life? When's the last time you, as an adult, you watched Ghostbusters?
I know people who watch it all the time.
It's weird. There's four women in this movie that are all very funny and credible and talented.
It's a killer cast. And yet we have all these weird, like, men's rights activists, like, getting up in arms about it. But I honestly feel like it's really not that big of a portion of men who are up in arms about it. I think those guys are the type of trolls that will spend 5 days making a bunch of fake YouTube accounts so that they can vote down the trailer.
What, really dumb question. What are men's rights activists?
Girl.
What is that?
MRA. Just look it up on Google and prepare for a wave of anger.
Well, that aside.
Look it up with, like, a bottle of red wine.
Yeah.
Okay,
and maybe a shotgun.
They're men who think that they're promised kind of entitlement of being rulers of the universe is now over, and they feel like this is unjust, and that they are now the persecuted minority.
Oh, got it.
With the rise of feminism.
Okay, so
you know how it goes.
Yes. Sure, yeah. Morons. I will say that Sony didn't make great trailers.
No.
No.
So the film does not look good.
It doesn't look good, but it's not because they're a bunch of women.
Right.
No.
Right.
The casting is awesome. I mean, yeah. At least in a sense of, yes, you can be funny.
But now they're responding to the trolls by putting out, they've got an international trailer out and they've got this. And then I've seen they've put less of some of the characters in and more of the other ones. They're trying to serve so many masters. You're not going to give these fuckboys what they want.
No way.
And unless you replace them with, like, Jack Black four times.
Well, not to side.
I would actually see that movie.
Poor Jack Black.
Wasn't that the fake movie from Tropic Thunder?
It was just
yes, Jack Black in every role.
Right.
The fatties. There we go.
The fatties.
I don't want to side with the MRA, but I don't want Ghostbusters remade.
I didn't ask for it. No, I didn't ask for it.
And I know that happens all the time, but I liked the movie as a kid. I will do, like, I'm only Zool, like, the line.
Well, I contend.
Like, I do that a lot. Like, and everyone knows what it means. Yeah. And it's like, it's a great.
There is only
I was
one
a kid
Zool.
When it would. Yeah, like, there's no somebody
there is
only
no,
Zool.
There's only
whatever,
Zool.
And the keymaster and the gatekeeper.
The movie only gets good from the time she gets possessed on. Everybody can agree with that.
But I'm just, I like
true.
It the way it
true,
is.
Thank you.
So.
I like a lot of things the way they are. I liked MacGyver the way it
well,
was. I liked Rush Hour the way it was. But they don't listen to us.
But is it coke? Anytime they just stick a bunch of women in a remake, like, it's going to be different because it's a bunch of women in it
well,
this time.
How often has that right. happened? I feel like this is actually relatively unprecedented. And so whether or not I think it's going to
well,
be a good
Charlie's
film.
I think Charlie's Angels was like that kind of model. Do you know what I mean? Instead of like a bunch of crime-fighting men, it's women.
But it's
I
already
mean,
been
sexy,
done.
But
it's the same story.
But this would be the equivalent of remaking Charlie's Angels, except with casting all men in it. This would be the
which
that equivalent.
I'm ready for it.
The studios would probably do that.
I'm with it.
That was the A-Team, though, wasn't it? Or something like that.
Like, the A-Team was shit. Here's the thing. There were common tropes that were interesting to us because we didn't have the idea of what was before that. Television was just hitting its stride in the late 70s, early 80s. So now we're talking about, you know, a movie that's seminal. It's a touchstone. It's a hallmark of our childhood. Did I need a remake of it? No. Mm-mm. I didn't need a remake of Evil Dead either, but I loved it.
But I think this is the thing is, we're going to get these remakes no matter what. And I think we've established in Pop Rocket, we're more or less exhausted by them. But if you're going to do it, and this goes back to something that we were talking about before we even, I don't know, when we were taping earlier, which was that if you're going to recast Bond, why not make it a woman? Why not make it a black person? Because it's going to get done no matter what. Just flip the script once in a while. So I'm excited to see what happens with the Ghostbusters remake. Not because I think it's going to be a great movie. I don't know. The trailers don't leave me optimistic about it. But just for them to try something different and then see what happens from it.
I'm going to go see it. If you can let Adam Sandler continue to make movies, then God damn it, by God, you let five women fall skulls.
I'm gonna go see it too, and I'm excited to see it. But at the same time, I wish they had just taken those four or five magnificent women that are in that movie and created a whole new franchise for them instead of just 100% plugging them into one that already exists. Personally,
I agree.
Anyway,
fuck boy.
It's basically a bunch of very hot actresses right now that they think they'll make a lot of money by putting them in a movie together, but right. nobody decided to give them an original screenplay of any kind.
But right. also, they're
so
going,
that's
they're,
sort of goes
I
back
hope
to
they
the
have
thing.
Hazard pay because they're going to get excoriated and they're going to be they're, that press tour is going to be a fucking nightmare. So I hope they have hazard pay, and I hope that their agents, Josh Katz, has put them into a scenario that can be plan B in case this all falls apart. But I will see the movie. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this with our gems.
Podcasts.
They're audio programs that
tell smart stories
in innovative ways
using editing techniques
like this.
But let's face it, all that smart stuff can be exhausting.
That's where Stop Podcasting Yourself comes in.
It's so stupid.
It's just two stupid dinguses
being dumb idiot jerks for 90 minutes.
Stop Podcasting Yourself.
The stupid show that smart people love.
Find it on iTunes
or MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Winter Mitchell. With me in the studio are
Oliver Wang,
Margaret Wappler,
and Sarah Lane.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask, what's your current jam? Oliver Wang?
I have been listening to a lot of Curtis Mayfield and The Impressions, and specifically a pair of albums which were recorded basically back to back. And you can sort of just group them into one mega album. In fact, I think there's a CD reissue that basically puts these two albums, which is This Is My Country and Young Maud's Forgotten Story. It was The Impressions at their most political and right before Mayfield left the group as the lead singer. And I've been just listening to these two albums over and over. And each time, every 2 weeks, I go through the listening to these albums, I just pick a different favorite song. So this week, the favorite song off of I think this is off of Young Maud's Forgotten Story. It's My Deceiving Heart. And if you were to ask me next week what my favorite song is off of these two LPs, I'd probably pick a different song. But the great thing about it is that you can always have a favorite song. Oh, I could die. So hard I cry. My deceiving heart has torn us apart. I'm gonna testify.
Part where I say I like it, and then Oliver says something back that he had to leave. so just pretend he's like, you know, waxing, intellectual, knows everything. Okay, Margaret.
Yeah.
What's your jam?
My jam is from Kate Le Bon, and it's called Are You With Me Now? And this song, I have to credit my husband, David, because he got me very into this song. I think it got thrown at us on the Spotify, what's the new Discovery
list.
And I've known about Kate Le Bon for a while, but this song is like the ultimate mellow cooking Sunday dinner kind of song. And she's got a new album now.
That is a quadrant.
It is. She's got a new album now called Crab Day, but this song is actually from her 2013 album, Mug Museum. So let's hear a little bit of it. Are you with me now? Good, right? She's got such great phrasing too. Like just the way she hits the words that she says is really there's a lot of artistry to it.
I like her voice.
Yeah.
She sounds a little bit like Joni Mitchell.
Just a touch, yeah.
Touch.
Yeah.
Just
she's new to me. She has a nice voice.
Yeah.
Margaret will do that for you. You'll get a lot of new to you. Sarah, who are you about this
Well, this
week?
Is a real 180 from Margaret's pick. This isn't a new song. Future, who's a rapper, he's from Atlanta. He's kind of a big deal. He is very prolific. He has like 14 albums a year. And earlier this year, he had a mixtape that was called Purple Rain, which coincidentally, I just thought about today when I was choosing the song. And I was like, oh, yeah, how weird. Yeah. You know, just a weird year for
and
Purple
Rain. And
his
t-shirts have a logo, have the same purple.
It's Rain, R-E-I-G-N. But
yeah.
Still, I was like, huh.
Yeah.
I had not really thought about that until just this moment. Anyway. Of that album/mixtape, there's a song called Wicked, and Future is sort of known for, he like kind of half talks, so he's sort of saying Wicked, but he's more saying reggae.
Yeah, I like
and
it.
And I love it, and it's my favorite jam when I'm driving and I'm angry.
Which is exactly where you want to be when you're with Sarah Lane, in the car with her angry.
God, it's a good one.
Metro Boomin.
This is like the Friday night shot music. You do your shots on Friday night, and then you listen to Kate LeBond on your Sunday night dinner.
There you go. You start here, then you end with Kate.
I love Young Metro as a producer. I mean, his influence on rap and trap, or whatever this genre is supposed to be called, is monumental. I love him.
They trapping.
Is trapping? Okay. Are they trapping? Trap out. Mine is The Palisades by Childish Gambino. Childish Gambino is one of those artists that I feel like has done a lot more for rap and hip hop-ish, whatever the in-between is supposed to be, than he's given credit for. So every time I come up on a track of his that I may not have heard before or I didn't actually know it was him, I'm forever impressed. This one is called The Palisades, which is where I would love to move into with Ben Affleck since we've confirmed that him and Jen Garner aren't getting back together. And
really?
No. I was upset for like a minimum of like 30 minutes because I thought they were, and then thank God Us Weekly was like, no, that ain't happening. I know the secret we share. Like every single quadrant.
Springy,
but it's also like a really good song to go into the summer. I'm excited about summer. And you know what, you guys? Let me say this since Guy's not here and can't stomp on me. If y'all don't up your musical palettes for the summer song choice, summer of the, what do we call it?
You talking to us?
I'm not y'all. I'm talking about the
listeners. Okay.
Because we've got to get out of this Ariana Grande world and step into a world that's evocative.
That's Guy's sweet spot, though. You're not going to pull him out of there.
I'm not going to pull him out of there, but I can encourage y'all.
Yeah.
To start thinking about what your summer jams are going to be.
Well, last summer, people suggested killer shit, and we made that great Spotify list.
We did make that great Spotify list. Yeah. So, like, I would implore you to, now that you've known us for a year, if you've listened since summer, we've elevated your taste profile, as Kanye calls it.
And we should say, too, that we just recently updated the Spotify
Thanks,
What's Your
Colin.
Jam list. So
Thanks.
It is filled with fresh picks.
I was like, what is going on? This list is old as F. Thank you for doing that. Thank you also for listening to Pop Rocket. Thank you.
While we're at it.
You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Winter Mitchell, with Margo Whopper, Oliver Wang, and special guest Sarah Lane. Sarah, what is your social addresses?
Sarah Lane. Sarah with an H, L-A-N-E. There are a lot of us,
wow,
but I'm the best.
Wow, you grabbed that? You grabbed Sarah Lane, like on Twitter. You're Sarah.
She's an early adopter.
Nice.
Yeah. That's what I do. Except on Snapchat, but we're
working
on that.
What are you on Snapchat?
That. Sarah Lane rocks. It's what I do, what Sarah Lane has taken, which is like once a quarter. Because I sign up for everything.
I sign up for everything, too. Even the shit that I don't care about. We post our show notes every week at MaximumFun.org. And you can also find links in the episode description of this podcast. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Aussie Miso. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Sandra6D for the 5-star review in iTunes. Sandra6D. Mm. What does that mean?
Maybe she's 60 years old.
No,
she changes it every year.
Six,
I'm 6D.
D-E-E.
Maybe she has big boobs.
Happy 6D.
Maybe
she's
6D's in. Hey, Sandra, don't remove that review. I love you. If you haven't already, please review us. If you got an opinion you want to share about this week's topic, You can join the conversation on our Facebook group or tweet at us. We're at Pop Rockets. We're a production of Maximum Fun, and I don't have anything colloquial to say about producers Christian Duenas and Colin Anderson.
They're just dudes.
They're just dudes.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.